Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So with the Media Project, you have an opportunity to get some commentary, analysis, and if you're lucky, even a little bit of insight into the news issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Good day. Nice to be here.
Sir. And Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, etc. Professor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Of course. Of course. And so we're here in Albany, New York, in the studios of WAMC. By which time you hear this, we'll have successfully concluded another amazing fun drive. One of the phenomena, actually, of public radio that we in our industry are talking about, perhaps trying to mimic as the business model for print journalism is changing, is the notion of membership, a notion that you're part of a greater whole, part of a team altogether. And that seems to work for you, Alan. That seems to be something that people respond to.
You're right, Rex. And I can tell you, I think it's a great idea. But of course, that means that you have a couple of models to go on. One of them can be that you turn what is, you know, a capitalist enterprise, a newspaper, into a not-for-profit. And if you turn it in for not-for-profit, then the people who own them now don't get the money at the end. The company gets the money. I know a guy who owned a big edifice somewhere. He spent a lot of his money to buy this thing, and then he turned it into a not-for-profit. But then as he was getting older in his life, he tried to sell it. And the feds wouldn't let him.
They said,
no, no. He said, but I put my money in the beginning. Tough noogies. Yeah. You don't get to sell that.
Well, you know, the model that Rex is describing, I would think would be more difficult for newspapers for any number of reasons, not the least of which is the connection that the listeners have with radio seems to be more personal. They hear the voices every day. It's more personality driven. And although newspapers like ours like to call ourselves your local newspaper, it works up to a degree, but I'm not sure it does that. The feeling of family is quite the same as with a radio station.
But don't you think the sense of family would be enhanced if the people who were putting in the money to support the station like they would a co-op in Great Barrington, mm-hmm. where everybody is the owner, enhances their sense of participation with it. I have to say that as the former publisher of the Fire Island Sun many, many years ago, it has its dangers.
It
has its dangers. I'll tell you the danger. There was this lady, let's just call her Sarah.
Was her name?
Sarah.
And I was at a party at my editor friend's house, and they had invited all of the big givers to this newspaper, which was everybody put $4,000 into starting this newspaper on Fire Island or something like that. And this lady came in and she came straight at my face. I was the publisher. The editor was there, but the editor was the mother, was the host of the thing. The lady came in and started crying and literally beating her chest and saying, after all that I have done, you didn't put my garden party into your newspaper.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
So then what happens is you get a certain amount of ownership, all right, which is great, but also a certain amount of expectation of what you are entitled to for doing
that. We get that now, just whether it's a subscriber or an advertiser.
Absolutely.
All the money we spent in your newspaper, and you're not going to cover our, you know, our charity or whatever.
That's right.
that's right.
Yeah, the opening
the
of your...
I will cancel my subscription immediately, and you will never see me again, at least until next week.
Okay.
until at least next week.
It is hard. Well, but everybody's trying to figure out the right situation, you know, which is the largest chain of newspapers. Is it still, or is yours
it
now
is,
bigger?
Yeah. Theirs is first, and ours, the Digital First Media, is second.
Uh-huh. Decent fourth quarter, full year financial results reported, but share price is off. And overall, the difficulty that they're looking at is that the paywall introduction, they've put all their content behind a hard paywall,
really,
is not leading to the kind of revenues they were hoping for.
That is so interesting. So, for example, I think that the New York Times must be doing very well.
Well, they are just, I was just looking it up. They're releasing this today as we speak, and I think the results are similar to what Gannett is experiencing.
I mean, really, the paywall is not.
Yeah, the paywall, and as we mentioned last week, my company, which has been very resistant to it, has also starting to institute a paywall, and I think it will succeed much like Gannett's did and the New York Times did in injecting some short-term, much-needed revenue. And the question is whether it will sustain itself. And the Gannett report suggests, no, that we got a lot of money the first year, but not necessarily since.
So what's the other side of that? In other words, you guys are in the newspaper business. I'm not. I run the Legislative Gazette, which is, by the way, a not-for-profit. But what happens if you're the editor, if you're the publisher, you're thinking, if I have a paywall, there's a certain amount of defined money I'm going to get. If I don't have a paywall, I'll get more people reading it, and as a result, I can charge for advertising and more advertisers because the number of people you're reaching is important. Is that what the offset is?
That's certainly been our position, our company's position, and I still think that that is the long-term...
You mean the second, not having a paywall?
No, right, not having a paywall and relying on numbers and advertising revenue, and I think the paywall, as I said before, is injecting much-needed revenue right now, and it will hopefully... be not as much needed going forward. But your question is a good one, because if the paywalls don't work and the advertising revenue isn't there, how many wedding festivals can we sponsor to make up some revenue?
Our current model, and we don't know if it's going to work, and nobody in the industry knows, is a kind of a mixture. We believe that we will have some content available on a free site, but that the hard news content, the stuff that people pay for to buy a newspaper, will also make available to people digitally for pay.
Right.
So that our best journalism is not going to be on that free site, but we will maintain a free site with a lot of other stuff. It's just that we're putting out multiple products in the same way that Special K cereal is no longer just a single Special K. There's Special K with red berries. There's a Special K that's cinnamon frosted. So we're putting out multiple products now, and part of that is part of the answer.
Well, it can be very frustrating, Rex. Just the other day, I believe somebody on your paper wrote a little something about me.
And, really?
Yeah.
Huh. And must have not been paying attention. I wouldn't have allowed that.
I know. And I tried to look it up on the available website. I have to remember to pay the money to get the full access to the paper. And I couldn't find it.
You couldn't
find
it.
So it was frustrating.
Right now, it actually is in there somewhere, but you'll be hard-pressed to find it on the free site. It'll be hard for you to find it. It's in the archives.
Is there a way to do it?
Search for your name.
Search for your name on the archives. Yeah. But the day that it's published in print, you'll probably find it a little bit hard to find it on the free site. You'd have to go buy a newspaper.
No, I'm going to buy it.
Well,
how much would it cost me?
A buck. buy the paper.
No, but how much would it cost me to buy an online subscription?
Well, you get a digital subscription, the replica, the e-edition, we call it, the facsimile.
That would be everything.
Everything, yeah. It's the same price as the paper.
Mm-hmm. The Berkshire Eagle has one.
Right, yeah. No inky fingers. Yep, we all have one of those. It's a good thing. What I don't understand, Ira, your company has introduced something new called unbolting, and I read an article about it, and I still don't quite understand it.
I'm not privy to the details of it, but it basically, our CEO, John Payton, who's been the Pied Piper of digital and who has not been afraid to go around the country and the world literally saying print is dying.
Mm-hmm.
And he is convinced that digital is the way to go. And I think, although all of the newspapers, and certainly mine, because I'm very happy with what we're doing digitally in terms of being innovative and timely, nevertheless, we are putting a lot of effort into the print product because it's very time consuming versus the digital. And so the digital is still... It's still the print and the digital, and he wants it to be the digital and the print, and in fact, unbolt the digital from the print, which sounds to me like it's more and more, don't worry about the print, we're out there, we want to do a newspaper, but your future is in digital, and let's not make it an afterthought.
Well, is he right? Not about that, but that newspapers are dead, basically.
No.
He's saying they're dying, but he's saying that.
I think that he's more pessimistic than we are. Otherwise, we wouldn't have bought a new press. Mm-hmm. I mean, we think that there will be a market for print publications. publications, maybe not as many print publications, but we think there's going to be a healthy market for print for at least a couple more decades. And that's worth paying attention to because that remains our most profitable line of revenue.
Could you say it depends?
It depends.
I mean, it depends. For example, you know, in a community like ours, Rex, I think the Times Union is a very valuable resource. It is everybody, you know, it is the newspaper, the anchor newspaper here. But there are places where the newspaper is not as relevant, and therefore you would think that if you had a digital site, you would be better off without having to publish, spend the money on the paper.
It could be, but there also is the other side of things, which is the so-called pure play digitals like Politico, which in this market, now Capital New York, you know, is launching behind the $6,000 a year paywall. They are actually creating print products ancillary to their digital offerings. Sure. So there's going to be a monthly or a weekly supporting them, which is the model that they've had in Washington with Politico.
I would say good luck, Charlie.
Yeah.
Well, I'm listening to what we're talking about, and we were talking about this, well, the last time I was here a couple of weeks ago, and I keep thinking that the listeners must be worn out by this, but I just can't emphasize enough, if you believe in newspapers and if you believe in journalism, you've got to be rooting for us to figure this out, because right now the trends are at the same time exciting and depressing, because there is all this prospect of the new technology and what we can do and all the things we're doing now that we weren't doing before. But it is depressing to come in and see numbers. Rex may not see them because he's on the editorial side. I see them on the business side. And you look at, you know, advertising figures and circulation figures, and it's, you know, that's what's paying the bills right now. So it's sort of a race.
But what I wonder is whether consumers are going to like the new approach. Now, this article that I'm reading, actually, that came from a Net News Check about your company, mm-hmm. Digital First, actually cites your paper, Ira.
Right.
Kingston
fellow. We have somebody named Yvonne Lahara, who's our life editor, who is also does corporate work in the digital. And he's one of the young geniuses of the industry.
So he's saying that all of your journalists need to get up to a benchmark of everyday social media usage and total comfort with the company's live coverage model of choice, Scribble Live. Mm-hmm. Then they have to work more with data and data visualization, so they gain fluency with data visualization. You know what that is?
It's a minimalist art area.
I'm one of those guys. When our CEO John Payton came on board, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's close, let's let the young people get involved and get the print guys out of the way. And I'm one of the print guys, so a lot of this stuff is very hard for me to get my arms around. So the answer to your question is I don't know exactly what it is.
But the sense is that crowdsourcing will make a difference. Yeah. That is, people creating. Alan, yeah. That's kind of what you were talking about in terms of community. People creating their own journalism.
Sure.
If you are part of the crowdsourcing where gasoline prices are lowest, or crowdsourcing where the Christmas light decorations outside homes are most beautiful, then you're actually a participant in creating the content, and maybe that helps to build the sense of association.
Well, I may be very tired, Rex, but crowdsourcing in this case means?
The source, that is, that, as I'm saying, the readers themselves create the content that goes up on
and
the site.
And that's Twitter.
No, not necessarily.
No.
The snowstorm, send us your snow pictures.
I mean, so you could do that with email, or you could do that with any number of
Facebook. We had on our Facebook page all of these pictures from around the region during the most recent snowstorm.
But it's interesting because we have a guy who's been helping WAMC for years with some occasional commentary and stuff, named Seth Rogovoy. And Seth Rogovoy puts out, you know, an entertainment thing, and as well as he aggregates news stories from around.
Digital, or is he print now?
He's digital.
He's digital, huh?
He's digital, and he's been doing it for years. Used to write for the Berkshire Eagle, doesn't anymore, puts this thing out. And recently he's been asking the people who get it every morning, I get it, for example, for money, and saying, I'm doing this, I'm telling you where the concerts are, I'm telling you what's going on, send me some money. And I'm sure some people are sending him some money. So this is evolving.
But is it enough for him to make a living?
I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it. It depends on where you live and how you live and what you eat.
And the difficulty is, while it may be enough for one guy operating a niche site like that, the problem is investigative reporting is tremendously expensive. And before you put a team of reporters on a project that will take them 4 or 5 months, which is not unusual in newspaper life, you have to have an assurance of a lot of revenue coming in. Folks are not going to just volunteer that amount of money.
Well, that's where these aggregators come in. Seth is an aggregator, for example, and If Rex puts five people on a news story for 5 months and puts it out in the newspaper, it's going to show up in the aggregator stuff saying, look at this. Look at how New York has a water supply and what it does with it and the rest of it. And all of your work will show up on all the aggregator sites.
It could make a guy grouchy. Speaking of grouches, by the way, this is what's known as the segue in radio. Bill O'Reilly.
Oh, boy. Now, see, there's a guy. As soon as I hear that name, I just really get red.
Yeah.
I mean, I really get very.
Did you see his interview with the president before the Super Bowl?
I did.
Quite a display, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was disgraceful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to pose two questions. One was, why, and it's not just Fox and it's not just O'Reilly, because this has been going on for years, why is there a presidential interview in the pregame show for the Super Bowl?
Oh, I think that's the White House's intention, because they know how big the audience is.
And do they feel, apparently not, but do they feel that the people who turn on the TV to watch the Super Bowl pregame, the last thing they want to see is a president, regardless of who the president is, talking about the weighty issues of
this
time?
This from Ira Fussfeld, the former sports writer.
Who almost never watches the Super Bowl.
I just want to point out, I did not watch the Super Bowl, even though I have relatives in Seattle. And I can only say that I think what happens is when these guys come before, it's a trade-off. It's like a marriage. Everybody gets something. The White House gets its visibility. Fox, which I consider to be disgraceful, gets to put O'Reilly on, and he gets to ask nasty questions, and he asks the president, were you upset by these questions? And he said, well, of course.
The fact is, you know, it's like it reminds me of the people who still keep raising questions about John Kennedy's assassination, questions that have been repeatedly answered by scientific examination. But the initial questions are still raised. The people who doubt that 9/11 actually happened as an accident, that the American government actually caused implosions that brought down the buildings.
Absolutely. We get them on the radio all the time.
Absolutely. And that kind of stuff. And that's exactly the way the questions that Jon Stewart was posing to the president are couched. O'Reilly's.
Because Jon Stewart took him to account.
Took him on. You're right. Absolutely.
Well, wait a minute. So part two to that. So now the president is on the Super Bowl. For whatever reason, he feels it's worthwhile. The network is happy to get him. They put on an interview. He only has 8 to 10 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the criticisms that O'Reilly got was the subjects that he chose. But the other criticism that O'Reilly got was that he was disrespectful. He wouldn't let the president answer. He was pressing him.
Do you think a permanent sneer is disrespectful?
Well, my question is, if you're going to walk in there with four or five topics you want to have covered, and the president, whoever the president is going to just talk on and on and on and run out the clock, what else can an interviewer do?
You might need to do some level of interruption, but is it disrespectful?
It's the game. We all have that.
Well, I think they both come out looking poorly when
this
happens.
Yes, that's right.
Who do you think ends up in this one, your assessment, gentlemen, of who did better as a result of this?
I think it depends on what kind of glasses you wear.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Dana Milbank of the Washington Post actually devoted some time to exploring the numbers.
Yeah.
O'Reilly, let's see. Along the way, he interrupted the president 42 times, Milbank wrote. Of the 2,500 words uttered during the interview, O'Reilly spoke 1,000 of them. He devoted nearly 40% of his time to the attacks on the U.S. facilities in Benghazi, 30% to the Obamacare rollout, and 20% to alleged IRS targeting. So those were the topics at hand. And I think it's a good question as to whether it's inappropriate for an interviewer to take up more than a third of the time allotted to do it for questions.
Sure, you can interrupt, but you don't have to do all of those words.
Mm-hmm. I have a homework assignment, as I often do. I commend you both and the listeners to pick up the most recent edition of New York Magazine and read Frank Rich's column. And his basic position is, why are the liberals in particular getting all excited about Fox News? Don't worry about Fox News. It has already done its thing and it's passé. And he uses, among his examples, one, the demographic. It has an older demographic that, sadly, much like newspapers, is dying out. But he had an interesting statistic. From 1952 to 1988, before there was Fox News, before there was Rush Limbaugh and the right-wing radio, Republicans won 7 out of 10 presidential elections from 1952 to 1988. From 1992 to the present, of the 6 presidential elections, Democrats have won 4, and one of the other two arguably should have been won by a Democrat. And those elections were all in the Rush Limbaugh Fox News era. So his point was, they don't have that much influence. They're talking to the choir. People who watch Fox News are not going to go to MSNBC and vice versa. They have a large audience for cable, but it's not that large an audience. As we discussed a couple of weeks ago, the lowest rated network news show still has many millions more viewers than Fox News's average viewership. So homework assignment, read Frank Rich in New York Magazine.
Very interesting.
You'll feel better about yourself if you don't like Fox News.
Assuming where you're coming from.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a difficult issue. By the way, if you folks have an opinion, you can send it to us, media@wamc.org.
You're crowdsourcing.
I am, absolutely. Actually, we did get a letter from one of Alan's former colleagues at UAlbany, a retired professor, who recommends that we check out a piece in the New York Times called Twinned Cities Now Following Different Paths, explaining the consequences that have befallen residents and business owners in Superior, Wisconsin, and Duluth, Minnesota, as a result of divergent paths in their state capitals. And I think it's just a significant note in that it signifies the value of good journalism, the people attached to it. I mean, who would think that a story about Wisconsin and Minnesota would be of great interest to somebody sitting in Albany, New York? But the fact is that kind of reporting, our correspondent tells us, actually is making a difference.
So, well, isn't that similar to the mantra you have here, where you're covering news from a number of bureaus, and occasionally sure. you'll get a complaint that says, why am I interested in what's going on in Springfield
somewhere
if
else.
I live in
sure.
Albany? And but the stories, the generic stories, do have some appeal because the same thing that's happening in Springfield may well happen in Albany or in Kingston.
Ira, you couldn't have put it better. The fact is that we have to tell our reporters that when they are doing a story in their place in Springfield or in Saratoga Springs or in this other place, to try to relate those stories to what everybody else is going. So if you've got a Board of Education story somewhere, it's unlikely that it won't have major implications for what every other Board of Education is going through. And it would be great if one can make those associations. I think it's the way to do it.
And it relates to newspapers as well. I mean, we cover the Red Hook, New York School Board, and somebody in New Paltz may say, why do I care about the Red Hook, New York? But they're invariably going to be talking about the same issues.
Sure.
So.
One more thing before we go, then, and
oh,
that
no.
is we need to blow the whistle on a lot of media outlets for bad reporting. A lot of media reports were covering the release of a Congressional Budget Office report on Obamacare, and a lot of them said that the report was warning that Obamacare would kill 2 million jobs.
I saw it.
This is reporters not understanding mathematics, I'm afraid.
And not necessarily anti-Obama reporters. This was,
right.
You
know. It's just bad reporting. The fact of the matter is 2 million people could exit the workforce as a result of the Affordable Care Act, but it's not because the economy would see a net decline in the amount of labor that workers choose to supply rather than a net drop in business demand for labor. That is, people choosing to quit jobs that they didn't like but were staying in only because of health care benefits.
Healthcare, sure.
Yeah.
Thus, people who are out of work could find work because there are now going to be vacancies. They're not eliminating the jobs.
Right. The jobs would still be there. It's just that certain people would not be accessing them. People now not going for work, not looking for work, could in fact be picking up those jobs. So it's really difficult. And as you especially in the era where we're trying to grab people's attention, folks don't have the attention that they used to have. What's that called? In any case, there's a little bit of a deficit of attention.
Attention deficit disorder. So, but what do we attribute this to? Is it just sloppy reporting?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's a new phenomenon. It's just that more people get their news from electronic sources than from print, and so it's more likely that you'll get this sort of headline stuff, 2 million jobs will be killed.
Well, I can't now remember the story. I'll probably remember as soon as we finish, but there was a story that the New York Times reported recently that was slightly inaccurate or needed slight revision. And in fact, so they posted the first story and then they fixed it on the website. I guess it was the Chris Christie story. And Chris Christie blasted the New York Times for sloppy reporting. Well, I don't know whether it was sloppy reporting, but it was initial reporting, which was quickly updated and clarified. Now, that sort of thing is more likely to happen now in digital, although it could have happened in print. If something made the first edition
yes.
and it was fixed for the second edition, now we're talking about hours of gap. So,
and the question is, do you have to let reporters, let readers know, gosh, we made this change and here's why?
That would be helpful.
And
media don't always do that.
And as you point out, you can make the change on digital real easily.
Yeah.
But
and immediately
go back to yesterday's paper.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, we're going to have to say that's it and bring back Pete for a little bit more of our theme song. Hey.
Extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspaperman meets such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.